This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. When you first take a look at it, the issue of measuring student learning appears to be an educational problem. What and how much do students actually learn? But when you investigate the educational accountability movement, especially here in the U.S., you realize that the preoccupation with measuring student learning is a problem that goes much deeper. That's what Josh Beach takes on in his two new books. They're called Can We Measure What Matters Most? Why Educational Accountability Metrics Lower Student Learning and Demoralize Teachers. That's Volume 1. Volume 2 is The Myths of Measurement and Meritocracy. Why Accountability Metrics in Higher Education Are Unfair and Increase Inequality. Josh Beach is the director of 21st Century Literacy. It's an educational nonprofit. I asked how he got started on this pretty big project.
Well, I mean, both personal and professional reasons. I have been a professor in higher education for about 20 years before I left to start a nonprofit. And so I experienced a lot of things that I have written about in these two books. Professional in that I don't think enough scholars are paying attention to the larger scope of educational accountability and what's going on in schools from kindergarten through college. And so I wanted to really fill in a lot of the gaps and paint the much bigger picture that most scholars ignore because it is too big in order to thoroughly explain all of the minute details, which is one of the hallmarks of good scholarship.
Let me get down to just one basic question. Is measurement of student performance vital, or is it not, or are we just doing it wrong?
No, yes, it is vital. It is vital. But we're doing it wrong, and we've always been doing it wrong. And doing it right involves more than measurement. And so part of the doing it wrong, the doing measurements wrong in schools, part of that is a technical question, a statistical question, a mathematical question, a scientific question. But part of it is also not scientific or technical. And so we have a lot of very smart people that have devised some very clever tools in order to make measurements. But number one, these tools are mathematically flawed, methodologically flawed. They don't really capture what they're supposed to be capturing, and they don't really capture what really matters when it comes to education. Now, when it comes to identifying what really matters, that's not a technical question. That's a moral question. It's a humanistic question. It's a political question. And when you have technicians who avoid the messiness of the subjective goals, values, which are behind every measurement, every theory of human action, when we don't have that discussion prior to making a measurement, the measurement's always going to turn out wrong. And so part of us adjusting the technical aspect is first having a conversation. What really matters when it comes to education? What is it that we value? And acknowledging that there are competing values, competing goals, and that we're going to need to make priorities. And we need to adjust our technical tools in order to accommodate those priorities and to negotiate those conflicts.
When talking about measurements, you say that IQ scores, SATs, grades, degrees, credentials are all measures that are flawed. Do many people agree with that, that they are all flawed?
I think for the most part, the technicians who develop these measurements know that they're flawed, certainly now in the 21st century. IQ, for example, when it was developed, and you know, grades is another technique that was developed in the early 20th century. Statistics was developed in the early 20th century. So when these tools were first being developed 100 years ago, the very smart professors and technicians didn't fully understand what they were doing wrong. Now we do. Now every educational psychologist understands the shortcomings of IQ. Economists who sometimes use that measure don't always understand the shortcomings. And so when it comes to understanding the technical flaws, part of the problem in the 21st century is that you have these different niches of experts who don't always talk to each other, don't always read each other's research. And so, for example, economists are measuring some things that have some validity, although there are some problems that economists talk about. But then when psychologists go to make their measurements, they often aren't fully aware of what the economists are measuring or why, and vice versa. And the psychologists have their own flawed measures. And so sometimes economists will draw upon the work of psychologists and vice versa, not being fully aware of the flaws. And then the real problem comes in is when you have educational administrators, deans or department chairs or presidents or school principals or, you know, superintendents, people who are not really experts, don't fully understand the technical details. And then they use these measurements in particular schools, and they often use them in very flawed ways. And then further on down the line, after the measurement has been used, we have to make sense of those numbers. And so again, you have these educational administrators, and sometimes teachers are involved in the conversation, but not always. You have to interpret, well, what do these measurements actually mean? What do the numbers mean? What are we going to do about these numbers? When people make those interpretations, there is a lot of error being made because people simply don't understand that those numbers are not perfect. And sometimes they can be completely meaningless.
You do make a claim in the book that says that schools, those administrators shouldn't be there. It should be managed by teachers. Should they just concentrate on teaching?
Again, it boils down to what do we want schools to do? What is the purpose of a school? If the purpose of a school is to educate, well, then educators should be in charge. You know, we could ask ourselves, for example, in the healthcare industry, what is the purpose of a hospital? Well, if the purpose of the hospital is to treat the patient and to make them feel better and to, you know, cure their disease, well, doctors should be in charge of that process, not administrators. But when it comes to education, it seems like teachers are often the last people that the community wants in charge of the process for some reason. Teachers are not really given the respect that they deserve as educated professionals who have technical knowledge, who are doing a very difficult job, and they need to be given a lot of latitude to creatively and flexibly deal with each child or young adult in their care on any given day. And I think there's a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of mandates that come down from on high that interfere with that process and make teaching more difficult and sometimes simply impossible.
When the American system of education was being put together back in the olden days, not many people had access to it. Now, just about everybody has access to it, in theory anyway. How did that change the way we educate?
Well, it changed the educational process in a number of ways. The opening up of education around the world in Western democratic countries happened in late 19th, early 20th century. But large numbers of students, the majority of students, didn't really get through high school and into college until the middle to late 20th century. And then in America in particular, we had lots of laws and also social customs that had a lot of prejudice in terms of, you know, gender and class and race. And so even when there weren't laws anymore, there were a lot of social customs that prevented students from freely choosing to go to school, to pursue a career. So when everyone was allowed in the door for the first time, which in this country was around the 1970s, which was the effort of, you know, a lot of people struggling valiantly against the powers that be. And it took a lot of bloodshed and negotiation and political compromise. But a lot of those students that had been prevented from utilizing the educational system weren't prepared for success. At the same time, there was an economic crisis that was happening in the 1970s, early 1980s. And so the notion that schools need to be much more frugal with taxpayer dollars and taxpayers very concerned about the amount of taxes that they were paying, at the same time that we had a lot more numbers of students in our middle schools, high schools, and then graduating from high school, going into college, there needed to be a lot more money in order to pay for a lot more resources to help these students through the pipeline. That always wasn't the case. And so students got in, but they weren't necessarily well served by what was there, the existing resources, especially students in urban school districts that were highly segregated by race and class. Students often were passed through the pipeline, you know, graduating from high school without really learning much, if anything. And then many of those students were kind of pushed to go to college or wanted to go to college, weren't fully prepared. In this country, the majority of students have been dropping out of college, you know, since the 1970s. A lot of students, especially poorer students, ethnic minorities, start their college education with the community college, but community colleges have been notoriously unsuccessful at getting students to earn degrees and transfer to four-year schools. Nationally, about 25-30% of first-year freshmen that enter a community college will actually end up earning a bachelor's degree over 6 years. So the educational system wasn't prepared. Traditional teaching methods that were largely a teacher standing in front of a class, delivering information, expecting students to do a lot of the work to simply memorize and utilize that information to know how schooling worked. Those new classes of students, they didn't understand the game. They didn't understand all the rules. They didn't have good reading skills or mathematical skills to be successful in the classroom. And so now, you know, in the 21st century, over the last two decades, there's been a lot more emphasis on teacher aids, teacher resources, personnel outside of the classroom to help students learn, tutors, educational specialists to kind of target need where need is not being, you know, served in the classroom. But the schools have needed to adjust, and some have, some haven't, but the results have been very uneven at best. Especially for underserved populations, ethnic minorities. One of the few groups that actually has done well is women. Women have been outperforming men for the last two decades. But there are certain areas in terms of STEM fields and mathematics that they aren't given the emotional support and the kind of motivation to struggle through, you know, predominantly male fields. And so very bright young women are graduating high school, getting into college, but they're, you know, not always feeling confident to go into the STEM fields and doing well in those male-dominated environments. So adjusting the social atmosphere, the political atmosphere, spending money on resources to help those students that need extra help. This has been a slowly emerging trend over the last, let's say, 40 years to get more students to be successful in terms of graduating high school, going to college, graduating with a degree, hopefully, you know, landing a good job when they get out.
Still to come, our conversation with Josh Beach continues with a look at the value of a really good teacher. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Josh Beach, director of the educational nonprofit 21st Century Literacy and author of two new books about student evaluation. In those books, he says that good teaching is still important and good teachers still matter. So I asked how valuable is a good teacher and what he calls a broken system.
It's an interesting question, and it's one that scientists are still figuring out. Based on the evidence, we know that teachers, in terms of the long run of long-term student success, of getting through high school, going to college, and then, you know, earnings in terms of labor market outcomes, teachers don't matter that much over the long run. About 10 to 15, maybe 20% of the variance in various student outcomes that have been measured, peers have the most, even more so than parents. And teachers and parents, they kind of in the 10-15% area. Students, in terms of their biology and their, you know, how smart they are, you know, how we measure that in various ways, their motivation, whether or not they have, you know, eaten well, have they gotten all the, you know, developmental processes successfully. So in terms of student outcomes, the student themselves and their personal experiences mingling with their biological maturation and their peer relationships are the two most important contributors to a student's success. Coaches, actually, based on preliminary measurements over the last few decades, coaches have more impact than teachers do. And part of that reason is because most coaches are able to select the athletes that are going to be performing on their team and on the field. And so there's a kind of a high bar in order to be with a coach on a, you know, a competitive team. You know, coaches generally choose the more motivated, more talented players. And so the coaching in that atmosphere tends to have more of an impact than teachers in your traditional classrooms, your typical classrooms. It's not a large amount, but there is a measurable difference between a bad teacher that does nothing and a good teacher. But this is one of the things that just we can't fully measure. And I know from my experiences, I'm sure you've have your own, you know, there were classes that you had mixed feelings about or even negative feelings about, but years later, it's like, hey, I remember that. You know, that really, you know, that kind of helps me in this situation. I can see how that made me a little bit different. So, I mean, the impact of a good teacher, it's not always realized at the time. And sometimes it takes months or years later for the student to fully understand what happened and how it actually contributed to their, you know, personal development and what they know and what they can do. So it's a very messy process that scientists are still trying to fully understand and measure and, you know, come to terms with.
That's a very interesting point, because I can think personally of, you know, going back to my high school years, thinking of them now, of some teachers who, yeah, made an impact, who I despised at the time.
Right, right. It's a fascinating phenomenon.
You bring up the Asian model back from ancient times to the present. Why do they seem to be doing it better, or are they doing it better?
In America, we have kind of this celebrated in some areas, denigrated in others, that this model of working really hard, of kind of being a drill instructor, of making students study hard and taking extracurricular activities, of kind of driving them to success. This derives from a Chinese model that was developed several thousand years ago, kind of a regimented, almost militaristic schooling model where students are processed for access to the bureaucracy. The ancient Chinese created the credential as we know it, the diploma. They created the kind of layered school system of schools passing through grades and taking a standardized test. And then upon, you know, successfully passing that test, you went on to more school or you got your diploma and then got a job. But that system was designed more for political and economic purposes to kind of feed students into the imperial bureaucracy of ancient China. It wasn't designed for the students themselves. But very few students actually made it through the pipeline. And there was lots of corruption and more corruption as the schooling, you know, kind of developed and the political system kind of began to crumble. But that model impacted the Prussians in the 19th century, which then impacted the Massachusetts school system in America in the 19th century. And that model then became the standard model all over this country and then all over really the Western world. It's a model of schooling that is more about socializing students for economic and political purposes, not developing students for educational purposes, not helping students understand themselves, helping them understand how to learn, helping them to prioritize what they want out of life, set goals and values, and then to, you know, acquire information and skills so that they can lead productive lives. It's more about sorting students, putting them into pre-described groups with labels. And then based upon those groups and labels, you're kind of pushed through a system and then you're squeezed out on the other end into some category which defines you for the rest of your life. You know, sorting students. And so that kind of system, it works. You know, there's things to be said positively about that kind of system, and maybe it's necessary. But at the same time, is there a better way to go about this? And are there other goals like, you know, giving students a say and, you know, thinking about what are they learning and how are they learning? Are they actually learning? And letting them have some say in terms of what they want to do with their lives and what they want to learn and how they want to live, letting parents have some input in the process. So I think that that ancient Chinese model of really regimented education, pushing students to succeed, I don't know that it's the best model. Certainly it's very hard on the kids themselves, and it really saps out a lot of the motivation to learn and to use that learning in creative ways, innovative ways.
Well, in the end, are you hopeful? Are some people doing it the right way, or at least moving that direction?
Certainly. There are many wonderful schools in this country that are doing great things. I think the Harlem Children's Zone is one of the shining examples of someone, Jeffrey Canada, looking at the big picture and really trying this massive experiment to bring traditionally underserved children up to speed and delivering really wonderful results. But the pessimist in me wants to say that, you know, most of the best examples that we have of working functional schools that are doing a great job tend to be in very rich white neighborhoods, that schooling is very polarized in America, still very segregated, and in many places more segregated in the 21st century than it was in the early 20th century. So there are a lot of great schools. At the same time, you know, just a few miles away, there are a lot of really bad schools that are not really serving their students. There were just some news stories today about some Baltimore City schools, you know, parents not being informed that their children were failing classes for years. And, you know, by the end of high school, they're letting the child know, hey, you can't graduate. You have to actually go back to ninth grade to start all over again. That a lot of our urban schools that serve poor students, ethnic minorities, they are underfunded, understaffed, and during COVID, just under assault. They just don't have the resources to do what they need to be doing. And so the outcome is that students are really suffering in many ways. And so we have that dichotomy of a lot of good schools. At the same time, we have a lot of bad schools. And then we have, you know, all sorts of stripes in between.
Well, somehow that pessimist in you keeps coming to the top.
Well, it's just one of those things that, I mean, the more you know, when you start to look at the data and the evidence and, you know, you're kind of overwhelmed by what is happening and all the problems, you know, you begin to kind of see that, and that clouds the frame, you know, especially for working professionals, you know, whether they're educational scientists or administrators or teachers in the classroom, parents that, you know, want a better education for their children. That when you are looking at the problems and are very aware of the problems, it's hard. You sometimes miss what's going right, you know, and even in the worst struggling schools, there are things that are going right. We don't always see them or acknowledge them. There might not be enough things going right, but, you know, whenever you have a concerned human being that is trying to help another human being and to make their life better in some way, whether it's in the classroom or in the hallway or in the gym, that's a success story. But there are a lot of problems and there are a lot of things that we need to be doing to make students fully successful for a very difficult 21st century, you know, world. And so as people that are trying to, education professionals trying to evaluate what are we doing, how do we do it better, I think it helps to be a little bit more pessimistic, a little bit more objective and looking at the data and the evidence and thinking more realistically. But certainly when you're on the ground and you're in that classroom, I think optimists should be in charge and that hope should be a big role, that who knows what we can do tomorrow, next year, next decade, that we can always do better and we can always strive to do better. And so even when we have a very realistic, if not pessimistic frame of mind when we're examining problems, doesn't mean that there's not a place for hope.
Josh Beach is the director of the educational nonprofit 21st Century Literacy. His new books are called Can We Measure What Matters Most? Why Educational Accountability Metrics Lower Student Learning and Demoralize Teachers. And the other book is The Myths of Measurement and Meritocracy, Why Accountability Metrics in Higher Education Are Unfair and Increase Inequality. There is a great old song by the group Tavares called Remember What I Told You to Forget. I promise I will not sing, but that could be the theme of today's Academic Minute.
We don't need to remember everything. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Torsa Gozal, assistant professor of English at California State University, Sacramento, examines why forgetting may be a good thing from time to time.
Is there value in forgetting? Brain games, health tips, and apps touted to solve our memory problems abound in the 21st century. Any exercise or application claiming to improve memory operates with certain assumptions about what memory is. They also automatically value remembering. But is remembering an essential good and forgetting necessarily a pathology? One place to look for answers to these questions is stories. Stories produce and circulate beliefs about how minds work and help us recognize the role of historical contingencies in dramatically altering our attitudes to cognitive functions. Take, for instance, Jorge Luis Borges' story, Funes de Memorias, first published in 1942, in which the titular character remembers everything, forgets nothing. Funes' memory is described by the narrator as a perfect storage retrieval technology. Such a description aligns with the view that the human memory is like an archive, a commonplace view in the Western culture. The understanding of human memory as an archive also guided early cognitive scientific and artificial intelligence research. Currently, though, the view that biological memory is a storage retrieval technology that can be perfected is questioned across many disciplines, including the cognitive sciences. Contemporary literature also participates in the questioning. Stories ideate about memory in the aftermath of present-day social and environmental crisis. For example, Lance Olson's Theories of Forgetting, a 2014 novel concerned with climate change, collages news clips, scraps, and images to present forgetting as a deliberate process rather than a fault in storage retrieval technology. Forgetting habits that have led to environmental crisis emerges as necessary for context attunement through the story.
That was Tor Sagosol of California State University, Sacramento.
You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.